It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later, we get the story behind a computer programming boot camp in Milwaukee that's looking to expand to other cities.
First, when it comes to determining the sexual orientation of someone we don't know, many people subscribe to the idea of gaydar, a supposedly intuitive ability to identify gay people by sight and sight alone. And while it's tempting to say that it's all in good fun, our next guest says not so fast.
According to his new research, there are two big problems with the idea of gaydar. Number one, it doesn't work. Number two, it can actually be a harmful form of stereotyping against LGBT people.
Here with us now to talk more about his latest research is William Cox. He's an assistant scientist in the Department of Psychology at UW-Madison. William, thanks a lot for coming into the studio today.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
So how would you define this term we're bandying about, gaydar?
So one thing is that almost anyone who even thinks of that term kind of has their own version of it, their own definition. But, you know, when we're trying to study it scientifically, we kind of try to hone in what the essential features are. And it's basically being able to tell that someone is gay without them directly communicating it to you in some way.
And there has been, it sounds like, some prior research before yours on this subject that seemed to confirm that, yes, there is this idea of gaydar that some people have, that they can tell someone's sexual preference just from these surface factors alone. What has that research been in the past?
So the past research, the biggest papers starting in 2008, showed that they argued that people have a facial perception gaydar process. So they took pictures of gay and straight men and also lesbian and straight women, showed them to people, and people, anyone, gay people, straight people, were better than chance at being able to tell who was gay just by the face pictures alone.
And you took a look at that study, and what did you find? You were not so sure about some of the way it was conducted.
Yeah, so we were trying to replicate the study. We didn't set out to challenge it. We were just kind of investigating it a little further. And what we found is that there were quality differences in the pictures for gay and straight people. So they used these pictures taken from dating websites, and we found that gay men and lesbians had higher quality pictures on the dating websites than the straight people. And the previous studies hadn't tested the quality of the pictures. And so then when we controlled for quality, either statistically or by picking like matched pairs on quality, the original effects just completely went away.
So do you ascribe that to the quality of the pictures?
Yes. Yeah, so based on the statistics we did and how the experiments we did, they indicate that the quality of the pictures seems to account for the past effects. And if you have this quality confound built in, we replicate the effects. We find the same thing. But if you take that away, there's no effect at all.
And so you wanted to go forward and see whether you got the same results, that gaydar actually existed. What did you do?
So I started with the idea that gaydar is another term for stereotyping. So when people are trying to determine who's gay or straight, they do it based on clothing or things like that, like, oh, look at what that guy's wearing, he's probably gay. And then this face stuff started coming around, and so I kind of set out to look at them together. So in the studies, we had the pictures of the gay and straight people, and I just thought I'd replicate the past effect, and I added manipulated stereotypic information. So in addition to a face that said something like, this guy likes shopping, or this guy likes the Packers, or something like that, so that then we could see how much of it is due to other stereotypic cues versus this facial perception process that the previous work found. And so then first we found that it was due to that quality difference, but then even when we had the quality difference in and people did a little bit from the pictures, they still relied much more heavily on the stereotypes.
Well, we're talking right now with William Cox, assistant scientist in the Department of Psychology at UW-Madison. He's talking with us about his new research challenging the idea of gaydar. Now, you said that you started this keeping in mind that gaydar was another form of stereotyping. How did that play out in your research?
So in the final study of the set, we were really looking at what this idea of gaydar, how it affects stereotyping processes, whether it affects stereotyping processes. And in culture with other stereotypes as well, racial and gender stereotypes, very often it kind of comes under the guise of an intuition where it's just, oh, it just struck me that that woman wouldn't be a good candidate for this leadership position. But really, it's your brain automatically activating stereotypes that we've learned from culture. And so the idea that gaydar, this intuition about who's gay, could be the same sort of thing really kind of fit with the work. So what we did in the final study in that paper, we manipulated what people believed in gaydar going into this task. And so we told some people, hey, science says gaydar is real. The past studies indicate that gaydar is this real perceptual process people have. And then there was a control group where we didn't tell them anything. And then there was a group where we said, actually, gaydar is just another term for stereotyping. They're really just two different words for the same thing. And when we told people that gaydar was real, they stereotyped much, much more than in the control group, which kind of supports the idea that the gaydar is what we call a legitimizing myth. It it's an idea and culture that legitimizes the stereotyping process by kind of camouflaging it as something else. And then when we told people that gaydar was stereotyping, they stereotyped at much lower rates, just of their own accord. We weren't encouraging them not to stereotype, but most people, their values say that, hey, stereotyping is not something I want to do. I don't like judging a book by its cover. And so just identifying it as stereotyping made people stereotype less because they're aware of it.
So you're using the word stereotype. Does that also mean that in its less benign forms, you could be talking about something like discrimination or prejudice?
So stereotyping, prejudice, discrimination are all very intimately related because stereotyping by definition is seeing members of a certain group in a very narrow way that they can only fulfill certain roles, perhaps in a professional context, and so on. And it's kind of well established in lots of other literature that stereotypes kind of legitimize prejudice. So by making, in this case, gay men seem frivolous and silly, they're into shopping and things that maybe aren't taken as seriously by some people, that makes their concerns easier to dismiss because it makes them seem like that whole group is frivolous. And then in some of our past work, these types of stereotypes specifically, when you're using a stereotype to make an assumption about someone, it's not necessarily publicly verifiable knowledge. So if I'm going around and I'm wearing a shirt that says I am gay and everyone knows I'm gay, if someone discriminates against me, maybe bullies me or commits a hate crime against me, people are reasonably going to kind of come together and say that was because of prejudice, that's problematic, and kind of punish the prejudice. But if I'm wearing something that makes someone infer that I'm gay, some kind of fashion or something that strikes someone as gay, it's not necessarily verified public knowledge. And so we looked at, and they can deny that prejudice plays a role in their actions if they express prejudice. We call this plausible deniability. We studied this in a shock paradigm in a 2014 paper where people were playing a game with a guy in another room and they got one little piece of information about him. They either learned that he was gay, like explicitly, so everyone knew, and so any behavior towards him could be attributed to prejudice, or they got a stereotypic cue. They learned that he likes shopping, which is something that in all of our studies, people very reliably infer that a guy who likes shopping is gay. And there's a subset of people who are personally very prejudiced, but they don't want other people to think they're prejudiced. So they only express prejudice when they believe they can get away with it. And when the guy was gay, those people didn't shock him very much because they knew people could accuse them of prejudice. But when we gave them the stereotypic cue that allowed them to infer his group membership based on the stereotype, they were basically allowed to engage in the stereotyping process and they could privately infer it and get away with it. They shocked him at much, much higher rates.
So you're saying people actually administered electric shocks to a subject more often because there were stereotypical cues given about this person.
Yes.
So how does that translate then to the real world? What happens when it's not electric shocks, when you're out there maybe in the workplace or anywhere else?
Well, one thing to emphasize from that study is that people who are personally invested in being non-prejudiced, people who are true, it's their personal values, their personal convictions say that prejudice is bad, they didn't shock the guy in either condition very much because they're good people, I would say. And it's, you know, this subset of people. So as far as most people, I think most people are going to fall in that category where it doesn't matter if you can get away with prejudice or not, you're going to behave consistently with your values. Someone who is trying to get away with it, this kind of smaller subset of people, it could definitely play out in actual hate crimes, bullying in schools. You know, if there's a kid who's out at school, that could actually protect him to a certain extent if the norms of the school kind of oppose prejudice. But if it's just something that you just kind of infer about someone and it's a kid who's not out at school, then the bullies might be able to get away with the prejudice more.
So why are people's judgments of sexual orientation so often wrong?
So this is something that we kind of show in the paper with just a simple mathematical proof. So at most, about 5% of the adult population is gay. And those numbers are just so hard to beat. So even if 100% of gay people actually seem gay based on the stereotypes, they're all just kind of walking around, fitting all the stereotypes. And so that's 100% of gay men, and only very, very, very few straight men, say 10%, seem feminine or effeminate and fit those kinds of stereotypes. Even though that's kind of a 10-to-1 ratio where gay men are 10 times more likely to seem gay, the mere fact that those gay men only make up 5% of the population means that there's still twice as many straight guys who seem gay. So there are just too many straight people who seem gay to let your gaydar kind of reliably make you correct more than you're incorrect.
So just briefly as we wrap up here, what is your overarching takeaway here in terms of people making snap judgments? What are we supposed to do with this information going forward?
I'd say in general, whether it's about someone being gay or anything else, you know, maybe kind of be a little more thoughtful and not rely as much on the snap judgments. So a lot of our snap judgments are just based on stereotypes and media representations that we learn from a very young age and usually probably don't reflect the individuality of the complex human being who's standing in front of you when you're making that kind of snap judgment. So just be a little more thoughtful and wait and learn more about someone rather than making an assumption about them.
William, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
That was William Cox, assistant scientist in the Department of Psychology at UW-Madison. He joined us to talk about his new research challenging the idea of gaydar.
Jobs in the information technology sector have been a big deal in the American economy for some time now, and lately there's been a lot of attention going to some of the informational raw material behind our smartphones, tablets, and computers, the programming language, also known as the code. A computer coding class in Milwaukee called DevCode Camp is expanding due to high demand for businesses.
There are more than 300 of these coding bootcamp-style programs around the country. The schools offer time-intensive, months-long programs that give students hands-on experience with the latest computer technologies and trends.
We're joined now by DevCode Camp's Vice President of Operations and Program Operations, Paul Jerovitz. Paul, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, tell us a little more about how this works. How does a boot camp in coding differ from, say, going and getting a traditional degree in computer science?
Well, like you had said in the open there, the first and most obvious difference is the time that it takes to be able to get this accomplished. Our students come in, and in 14 or 20 weeks, they are now qualified to be a junior developer. And that doesn't mean that we skimp on any of the actual material. What we do is we just focus all day, every day on coding, and it is project-based. It is hands-on, heads down, and our goal is to make an extremely relevant software engineer in a short period of time, and our hiring partners would agree that it works.
And this is a full-time gig when you sign up for a class, right? Like, I mean, we're talking 40, 50 hours a week, right?
Yeah, we have a full-time offering that is actually 50 to 60 hours a week.
Wow.
And then we have a part-time offering that is right around 30, 35 hours a week. I would not suggest having a full-time job during the full-time program. This is your full-time job.
Now, for people not familiar with computer code, when somebody sits down day one of this class, what kind of things are they learning in that 50, 60 hours a week?
Well, we start everybody at the fundamentals. We want to make sure that everybody understands how to be an efficient, effective coder. And what we want to make sure that you come to the table with is a good foundation, regardless of what technologies you're using or what languages you're coding in. We start everybody from the ground up, but we accelerate extremely quickly. We ease into this with a language called Python, and then we get into the heavy lifting, which is our C#.NET focused portion of the program. And we picked that language because it is extremely important to businesses in Wisconsin. A lot of these boot camps that you had mentioned focus on a lot of different technologies, some that sometimes lend themselves to a more accelerated learning setup. But it was our goal to make sure that we were creating people that could get jobs in Wisconsin.
Now, we encounter code a lot in our daily lives without being aware of it. I don't know what's under the hood in this tablet I'm looking at right now. So how does code play out in our lives? What does it do for us?
Well, I think there's this common misconception that software engineers or coders are these, like, super math whizzes, and you've got to be this, like, very, very, have this very scientific brain. What you need to be is you need to be a problem solver. And I think, you know, like you said, there's software everywhere. It's in our cars, it's in our phones, it's in our TVs. And somewhere out in this world, somebody's creating that code. And these people are typically people that look at something and look at it a little bit in a different way and decide that they're going to make this better for us, or they're going to make it easier, more convenient, or it's going to be faster or smarter. We've had people come to us with no coding experience, but they just had a mindset of wanting to solve problems, create meaningful things, and they wanted to They wanted to be able to make this their career. Ultimately, I don't think there's really any limitations as to what software can do. It just becomes more important in our lives.
Talking to Paul Jarovitz from Dev Code Camp. It's a coding boot camp, giving prospective programmers a quick start, a jump start for hopefully a future career. So what kind of accreditation is out there? There are all these companies, including yours, your license, as I understand it, but not accredited. Why did you go that way?
Well, we decided to decline it simply because it handcuffs us. We are not able to react as quickly as we would like, and it hurts our students. Our hiring partners don't like it when we can't make changes quickly. As you know, technology changes very quickly, and we need to be able to adapt. That is, another one of the differences between a program like ours and, say, a 2 or a 4-year degree is we've created a real-life environment here. Our students come out extremely relevant. If there is a technology that companies are using today, our students are using it. They're familiar with it. They're busily on their way to mastering it, as opposed to learning about theory. And we spend probably 20% of our time discussing and lecturing, but the balance of that, the 80%, is actually coding. So the main reason was we didn't think it really benefited the student. We weren't able to change as quickly as we'd like. Sometimes these things can get caught up in pushing paper around for 6 to 12 months, and we wanted to do better by our students.
The program started small, as I understand it, with a summer pilot program. Do you know how the students are doing now, the graduates of that first incarnation?
They are doing great. We had a meetup last night where we were teaching some beginners HTML and CSS, and we had a couple of the graduates come after their work. They're working at places like Xiwave and Tricep Solutions. They are right out of the gate becoming an extremely productive member of the team, because they did live through this 50 to 60 hour a week, fully immersive, intense program. So when they got out into the real world, it was almost like they had been working for that company for the past 3-4 months. What we're finding is, if you are a person who is hardworking and you have an aptitude, you're a sharp person, and you think this might be a good avenue for you, if you put forth the effort and get through it, there are jobs out there. There is no doubt. And it's not just in the tech hubs that we think of, like San Francisco and Portland and Austin. Milwaukee has plenty of jobs. One of the easiest things there was to do with putting this program and getting it up and launched was building the hiring network. And it's not because we had some magic wand or a magic potion. It was just there are a gigantic amount of jobs available and not enough people. So, the Bureau of Labor Statistics says there's about 1 million software development jobs out there today. We're going to add another 250,000 in the next 10 years. I think that's a low estimate, but ultimately, the demand is what makes something like this successful. The demand, with a combination of the right student and the right instructors, putting all those together, it's a win-win-win for everybody.
Now, Paul, when I was a kid, we had BASIC. I was able to play with it enough to learn that I would not be a programmer. I didn't have that level of attention to detail. Since then, though, I've heard that our equipment, our technology is so high-tech, it doesn't give kids, youth, the access to coding, to start tinkering and start learning it at an early age. Do you think that's changing? Are there any efforts out there to make that sort of thing available to kids before they're hitting boot camp stage like yours?
I think it's only a matter of time before Milwaukee gets caught up with things like the Hour of Code and Code Academy and a lot of these free online resources for kids. We're actually putting together a program with some grade schools in the area where we're going to invite kids in and teach them some of the basics of coding and get them interested in it and show them that, hey, you can make a career out of this, and you can dig into it at an early age. It was one of the initiatives that we wanted to put together, was sharing this knowledge with young, old, and everybody in between.
Now, you've mentioned we're not talking scientific super geniuses needed in these jobs. You mentioned hardworking. What else, if there was a core personality type or maybe job trait for someone to be successful in this line of work, what would it be?
I would say the most critical thing to bring to the table is you have to be persistent. Our instructors understand that, sometimes coding is a series of failures until you finally figured it out, and then you've got the coder's high. If you're somebody who throws their hands up at every little issue and walks away and tries to find somebody to fix it for you, this will be miserable for you. But if you're somebody who clears the calendar and sees a problem and decides you're not getting up from that chair until you've come up with a solution, then it's probably going to be a great career for you.
So it's Sudoku star might be a good fit.
You got it. Somebody that's looking at it and thinking, huh, okay, maybe I just need to look at this a little bit differently, mm-hmm. but ultimately I'm not walking away until I come up with a solution to the problem. And that's the first thing we look for in our students. It's not math or science or any of these other things. It's tell us a little bit about your problem-solving abilities and techniques.
We'll leave it there. Paul, thanks so much for joining us today.
I appreciate it.
That was Paul Jerovitz telling us about Milwaukee's Coding Boot Camp, Dev Code Camp, and the rising trend of these schools nationwide. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up later, we'll hear about a Democratic proposal to replace the state's job agency, the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation.
First, a proposal from a Republican state lawmaker would allow the governor to appoint the state school superintendent instead of citizens voting to fill the position.
The proposal would require a change of the Wisconsin Constitution, which currently establishes a statewide election for superintendent every 4 years. In order to become a reality, the proposal would have to pass two consecutive legislative sessions and a statewide referendum.
We'll talk to two guests on this topic today. Representative Joe Sanfilippo is first. He's the Republican lawmaker who's sponsoring the proposal. He represents Wisconsin's 15th Assembly District, which includes New Berlin. Representative Sanfilippo, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So the basics, why the change? Why do we need to change the way we select our state school's superintendent?
Well, I think if you take a look at our schools, our public schools around the state, we barely have 37% of our kids at the proficient level in reading, and that's not a very high bar. And so if you feel that that's adequate and you're satisfied with those results, then you probably think we don't need to make a change. But I'm not satisfied. I think we can do much better, and I think that we need to make a change at the top and at the structure of the entire DPI infrastructure, decentralize a lot of this power that's been amassed in Madison and send it back to the school districts. And the way to start with that is to make this appointment or this position a cabinet appointment just like all the other state agencies.
So lay out the nuts and bolts for us, please. If this went through the constitutional amendment process, what would happen? What would change?
Well, again, I think you're going to increase the accountability to have a superintendent who's in a cabinet-level position, because right now, anytime the governor or legislature has wanted to make changes in the past, and this goes beyond, this isn't just about this superintendent. This goes with the position as it's been for several decades. When changes have tried to be made in the past, you've had the superintendent kind of leaning on the Constitution as a crutch, saying, you guys can't tell me what to do over there in the legislature because I'm separately elected, so I'm going to be able to do whatever I want. So you have kind of this breakdown of cohesiveness in between the legislature and the governor who set policy and charge the taxes to the citizens that support the school district and then support the school system, and then the person who ultimately runs the school system. So I think it's important to just create this for a cohesive nature, to create this back in a created as a cabinet position and increase the level of accountability.
Well, the idea of the elected position, as I understand it, would be that the superintendent is accountable to the voters who can fire him or her every 4 years, and to insulate the education policy from the whims of partisan politics. How do you respond to that argument?
Well, I don't think, first of all, that we're taking anything away from the voters, because this would be done in a constitutional amendment, which, as you know, requires the approval of the voters. So the voters would be approving to turn this into a cabinet position. They're going to have direct say. So you can't get more democratic than putting it in the hands of the voters as to do we want to make a change. But I think the fundamental question here, you know, even though the question is do we amend the Constitution to change the superintendent, the fundamental question here is, are you happy with the state of our public school systems, or do you think we can do better? And if you're satisfied with two-thirds of the kids in our state not being able to read proficiently, then you're going to be okay with the status quo and want to keep it. But if you, like us, think that there's room for improvement, then I think you're going to want to make a change.
Would it be a sure thing, though, that the appointee of a Republican governor, as it stands now, or a Democratic governor would necessarily do something better, or would they just be pursuing the partisan agenda, Democrat or Republican, of whoever appoints them?
No, I don't think that you're going to have politics into this at all. In fact, if you take a look over the last half century, we've had 10 different governors. 5 were Republicans, 5 were Democrats. So this really looks like a pretty fair and balanced approach to being able to attract a superintendent. But when you vote for governor, the governor is basically in charge of the operations of the state. So it really doesn't make sense to have one of the most important agencies that I would argue, which is educating our children, just completely outside of the reach of the governor. And, you know, and again, whether you're a Republican governor or a Democrat governor, you're going to want to make sure that you're providing the best opportunity for education for your kids, for the kids in the state. And that governor and legislature are going to face the public much more frequently and in much more heavily turnout voter elections than does the superintendent currently.
We're talking to Wisconsin Assembly Representative Joe Sanfilippo. He's a Republican from New Berlin, and he is proposing a change in the way Wisconsin selects the head of the Department of Public Instruction. Currently, as the Constitution stands, that's an elected office. Under this change, if the Constitution were changed, this would be appointed by the governor. Let me put an asterisk on that, appointed by the governor. As I understand the proposal, Representative Sanfilippo, there would be some legislative oversight or a chance for a do-over from lawmakers. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that you have almost a vote of no, you know, we have the ability to have a vote of no confidence, really, in the legislature, that if the legislature is not satisfied with the way the cabinet head is performing their duties, they can go to the governor and say that, you know, a change needs to be made. So, you know, I think it's important to look in the whole context of this is that, you know, there's only 12 states in the country that elect a superintendent of their schools. And so that's something that, you know, what we're doing really is kind of outside of the norm to begin with. And of the states that do elect a superintendent, nearly half of those states with elected superintendents are in the top 10 worst school performing school systems in the country. So there is some correlation here to having an appointed position, so you get a qualified person with the credentials to actually run the school system, and having better achievement with your students.
Well, Wisconsin does well in some measures of achievement. I mean, there are racial disparities that a lot of people point toward, but in ACT scores, we're usually in the top number 2 or number 3 in the country. So it's not all bad under the current system, is it?
No, there's definitely some bright spots that are emerging, but the problem is they're taking years and years to emerge. And I think that, you know, again, take a look at our graduation rates. They're especially horrendous in our urban centers, which are primarily minority and children of poverty-stricken families. And so we're not doing them any good in getting themselves to be able to lift themselves out of the poverty if we're not getting them to graduate school, we're not getting them to be able to read, their math scores are subpar. And it's just, you know, it seems to me that DPI over the last few decades has been willing to just sit back and accept the status quo and not demand more changes. And again, whenever the governor and legislature have tried to make improvements, they have rebuffed those improvements, just using the Constitution as a crutch to lean on.
Well, the current DPI superintendent, Tony Evers, has asked for more resources. He's come on the show saying that they've been cut a little short in some of the districts you've mentioned by the executive branch. What solutions do you think that have been proposed has he shot down on his end?
Well, I think Tony Evers is using a false premise. He's trying to say that there's some correlation between the amount of money spent on education and the achievements realized. And there is no study or report in this country that definitively says the amount of money spent on education leads to or has an effect on the achievement or the results of the students. In fact, here in Wisconsin, we're one of the highest spending per pupil in the country, yet we don't rank near the top in the results. And when you look at those that do rank near the top, some of them are some of the lower spending ones. And so that's just a false premise on his part. And again, it's another avenue that he's been able to take their failures and pass them off on the legislature and the governor as though somehow it's our problem, when we really don't have the control, because he's in complete charge of that department. We can't say or do anything to make him do one thing or another, but yet when they're falling on their face and they're failing to educate our children, he turns around and blames it on the legislature and the governor, and that's just not true.
So you've unveiled this legislation for a constitutional amendment. What kind of reaction are you getting so far from fellow lawmakers who'd have to support you in passing this once and then again?
Yeah, I think I've had a lot of positive feedback. You know, this is something that I hadn't discussed with anybody before I put this out. I've been thinking about it and researching it. This is going to be one of a host of DPI reform bills that I'm going to be rolling out over the next few weeks. And we've had a lot of positive feedback, because I think overall, when you take a look at the jobs that we have available right now in this state, we've got over 80,000 jobs that we're trying to fill, and we cannot fill them. And a large part of that is because we're not educating our children and giving them the foundation that they need to be able to go in and get these good family-supporting jobs. And it really is just a shame. And again, when you look at our larger urban areas, you see this cycle of poverty that just goes over and over and over, and it starts with an education.
And Representative Sanfilippo, before we let you go, do you have a timeline in mind for getting this constitutional amendment through the whole process?
Well, as you know, we're going to have to pass it through two sessions, and then it goes to the public. So, I mean, this isn't something that's going to happen overnight. It's going to be several years if this were to come to fruition. But the important part is for us to start taking some action right now and start talking about this and other measures that we need to do to make some improvements in our educational system. Because as we talk to experts out in the field, our workforce is shrinking dramatically, and we are having a void in being able to fill these positions. And so it's going to be in the best interest of not only individuals themselves, but of the state as a whole, to make sure that we have kids with a good education that are able to go out there and fill these jobs. And right now, 37% reading proficiency is not going to do it.
Representative Sanfilippo, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
That's Representative Joe Sanfilippo, Republican, representing Wisconsin's 15th Assembly District, which includes New Berlin. He's with us to talk about his proposal to allow the governor to appoint the state's school superintendent.
We're picking up our discussion now about a proposal to change the Wisconsin Constitution to allow the governor to choose the state school superintendent instead of keeping the job an elected post. We just heard from Representative Joe Sanfilippo, the lawmaker behind that proposal.
Now, Reed Riggle joins us. He's co-chair of the Teacher Education Program at St. Norbert College and president-elect of the Wisconsin Association of Colleges for Teacher Education. Reed, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And I'll invite listeners to join in. What do you think of this idea? Replace elections with appointment by the governor for state superintendent. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Reed, your first reaction when you heard about this proposal, what did you think?
Well, it seems to be an attempt to remove from the public the right to choose who leads our school system. So constitutionally, we've long had the right as citizens of Wisconsin to elect the leader of our public school system. And, you know, that fits into our democratic structure. And it gives voters every 4 years, you know, the chance to say this person is doing a good job or this person is not doing a good job, and make that decision themselves. And I think in a system that is based on local control, that's an important attribute to have. And education is a state's rights issue, and so the state leader of education is critical to the education system in the state of Wisconsin.
And we heard from Representative Sanfilippo saying, in effect, this is an inefficiency. You've got an extra layer. Anytime you want to change something, you have one party or the other who can block things. Why not make it more efficient, have it appointed by the governor, have everybody on the same page on schools policy? What's wrong with that idea?
Well, again, another basic democratic principle, separation of powers, right? That if you allow for an appointed position, then you are centralizing power in the governor or the legislature, and there's no counterbalance for that power. There's you know, and so the issue becomes that you may politicize the process, and not necessarily so, but you know, there's a distinct possibility that an appointee by the governor would then be beholden to the governor to do what the governor wants to do, rather than an independent voice saying, you know, this is a better policy than what the governor has in mind.
And the representative made the case that Wisconsin schools not doing that great. He cited low numbers and some standardized tests. So when it comes to reading proficiency, for example, the idea that in a sense, Wisconsin schools are failing more or less. So how do you evaluate the state is a big question here, the state of Wisconsin's schools and the outcomes for students?
Right. Well, I think that's he talked about, you know, a sort of a false premise. I think that's a false premise, that schools are failing. And to focus in on a single number like that doesn't capture the complexity of what's going on in our education systems. The reality is that schools are situated in communities, and the children who come to those schools are coming from those communities, and they're bringing with them all of the qualities and characteristics that are developed within that community setting. So as Superintendent Evers would tell you, we have the biggest achievement gap or opportunity gap in Wisconsin than any other state in the nation. He has a task force right now that's working on that, made up of educational leaders from across the state. And, you know, the problem there are systemic in part maybe from the school system, but they're embedded within communities, right? The poverty doesn't exist in the schools. The poverty exists in the communities, and then the children who live in poverty come to the schools. And so it's a false premise to think that schools can address all of the ills of a community simply by educating children. And so I think that's a fundamental challenge. Should we be doing better? Of course, always. We want to raise the proficiency of all of our children, and that's another piece of the equation. We're trying to educate every child at a high level. And so that challenge alone is different than what some other nations try to do. You know, they may shift kids off into different tracks and not necessarily try to get every child up to a level so that they can be a productive citizen as we do. So I think the important thing is that we're trying to do something that's very challenging in a context in which the social structure of our society presents us with some challenges as educators.
Talking to Reed Riggle from St. Norbert College about a proposal to change Wisconsin's constitution, let the governor appoint the head of the Department of Public Instruction instead of an election every 4 years. We'll go to our callers now with Ann on the line in Green Bay. Ann, hi.
Hi. Thank you for having me on. I would just like to say how completely opposed I am to this proposal to change the constitution. This is simply one more ploy by the Democratic Assembly or by the Republican Assembly to take the people and the public out of public education. And unfortunately, I think there is a potential that this will get some traction among certain people. But your current guest accurately pointed out all the flaws in the logic. There are pockets of schools in Wisconsin who are struggling. But for every school that's struggling, you can point to other schools that are far exceeding national standards. And just take a look at AP test scores. Take a look at performance on other standardized tests that compares Wisconsin, Minnesota, Iowa consistently among the top achieving states in academics compared to other states.
And thanks a lot for the call. Reed Riggle, thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that's a very good way to put that. You know, of course, if you're going to distill things down to a single number, you're washing out some of the complexity in what's really going on there. And we do have many schools and communities where things are very, very successful. And that's sort of what I meant, in that the pockets or the localized issues are based on those community issues. And if you take a more community-based approach, don't expect schools to solve all the ills of society, but address it in a more holistic fashion and say, well, schools will be part of the answer, but they won't be the answer.
Thanks a lot for the call. And Nick is with us next in Greenfield. Nick, hi.
Yeah, hi, and thanks for taking my call. I've got 3 points here to make. First of all, Sanfilippo said that more money won't make it schools better. Actually, that's a bald-faced lie, because more money would pay for smaller classes and for more teaching assistants, which would definitely improve education. Second of all, the Wisconsin legislature, just like your previous caller said, is trying to starve the public school system by cutting more and more money away from it. And last but not least, Sanfilippo is just a mouthpiece for Scott Walker and the American Legislative Council, and that is a think tank group.
Nick, I want to bring Reed Riggle in for a response to that that second point. This is just trying to concentrate power in the hands of the governor. Do you think ultimately, Reed, that would affect the quality of education in Wisconsin that much?
I don't think there's any question. I think we have to remember this is public education. And when forces beyond the public begin to have influence over the process, then we begin to lose the public education piece. Let's be clear. Education is a public good. It is the foundation of our culture. It's the foundation of our society. And we have to treat it as such. It's not a commodity. It's a public good. And so we, the people, should have the right to protect that public good.
And then as we wrap up, do you think this is going to fly? I know you study education more than the politics of Wisconsin, but are you concerned that this might actually come to fruition?
Well, I hope not. The unfortunate thing, of course, is the math. If you look at the legislature, if it runs along party lines, whatever they want to pass right now, they're going to pass, because the Republicans have control of the legislature and the governorship. So, you know, the good news is that even if it does happen, again, which I hope it doesn't, it will, because it's in the Constitution, it will come to the people for a vote. And I hope the people would see that this would remove their opportunity to control something that's very important. And I would hope they would choose not to support such an amendment to the Constitution.
Reed, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Reed Riggle, co-chair of the Teacher Education Program at St. Norbert College, president-elect of the Wisconsin Association of Colleges for Teacher Education, talking about the proposal to allow the governor to choose the head of the state's Department of Public Instruction instead of voters electing that position. We also heard from the sponsor of that constitutional amendment, Representative Joe Sanfilippo.
Coming up, we'll hear about a proposal to replace the state's jobs agency, the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation.